Welcome to the Deep Dive Perspective. Purim, Passover, Israel, the war on Iran. We've got a lot on our plate today. Gilad Atzmon is my wonderful guest today. He does interviews very rarely, but a very colourful career as an international jazz musician, a best-selling author, served even in the Israeli IDF once upon a time as a conscript, but has very strong views around the whole notion of Israel and the religious connotations around Israel, something which is very touchy and a lot of people get very scared of dealing with it because that anti-Semitic word will come up. But I'm talking to an Israeli, I'm talking to someone who I would assume is a Jew, I'll find out, but and what does that mean? And what are the consequences of being of this identity today in the contemporary situation? And where is the world going with what Israel has essentially done in this last couple of years? Gilad, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm very happy to be with you. As you said, I rarely do interviews. Actually, I don't do interviews at all. And I don't even understand why I'm doing it now. But there is something that I saw about your writing that captured my attention. I had a feeling that, as you said, you are ready for a deep dive. I agreed. I kind of constantly refuse to give interviews. And one of the reasons is that I was predicting this disaster, the current catastrophe that we are all facing. And it was very interesting to talk about it or to analyze it philosophically and metaphysically in future terms. But now it's basically mainstream news. We see what the Jewish state is up to. We see what its most dedicated colony, the United States, is up to. I thought about it today. I heard something about somebody kind of discussing the notion of Judeo-Christianity, which I always found ridiculous. What we see in practice is the Judeo world enslaving a segment of the Christian world, what we call Christian Zionist or whatever. It is tragic and it's very, very dangerous. But, you know, talking about it as it happens in front of our eyes wasn't very, very, never been very interesting for me. So I basically quit the public arena, and I concentrated on playing music. I like spreading beauty. It's much more fun.
Well, that's fascinating. You've already touched on so many raw nerves there. It's going to be really interesting to delve into. First of all, you called America Israel's colony, which many people would straight away, it would be alarm bells for many, because there's this big debate about whether it's Pax Americana, Pax Judaica, or whether we're still living in a Pax Britannica.
There was a big debate about it, whether it is the dog that wags the tail or the tail that wags the dog. One of the people who are responsible for this confusion is Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, Epstein, a great friend. I never bought into it from my very early days of growing to be an analyst. I realized that Israel buying itself more and more power within American politics, understood the role of AIPAC. It didn't start with Trump. It didn't start with Biden or even with Obama. It goes well back to the late 60s, actually. Mm. We see the rise of APAC. We saw Pollard, Jonathan Pollard affair at one stage, which was obviously an espionage affair. And we are all aware of the Epstein scandal, which is basically an espionage network that was specializing in sexually related a blackmail operation. Now, I'm less interested in political affairs, and I'm more interested in the cultural, the metaphysics, the spirit that sets these affairs. I'm more interested in the Jewish text, for instance, that formed or contributed to Israel to become what it is. So, for instance, we can talk about the biblical homecoming that and the way it is presented in the Old Testament as a promise and a genocidal affair, and to understand the operation of Israel as it becomes more religious, more Judaic, as an echoing system of that brutality. And this is pretty devastating, I agree with you. You said that at one stage, when you introduced me, actually, you said that I'm an Israeli and a Jew. So it's very important to make it clear. I was born in Israel many years before I understood that Israel was Palestine.
Sure.
But when I was 25 or 26, I understood it, and I couldn't live there any longer. It took me another 4 years, maybe. But when I was 30, I left, and I never came back. And if I come back, I'll come back when it is Palestine. And I won't come as an invader. I would come just to visit and to play music and
well,
this
is a really interesting thread that you did touch on straight away. And I mentioned Purim, I mentioned Judaism, and I mentioned Israel specifically.
Yes, before we touch that, you know, and also I realized, because I never been a religious Jew, I understood that if I'm defined as a Jew, it is basically a race-related identity. Yeah? I realized many, many years ago, 25 years ago, that I'm not just an ex-Israeli, I'm an ex-Jew. I want nothing to do with this identity, not only because I don't agree with their politics. It would be against every moralist, universalist understanding of my existence to be a Jew, especially because I'm not because I've never been religious. So I would have to identify politically and culturally with my biology, which is something that I'm not willing to do.
That's fascinating, because, of course, this is a massive debate. Are Israelis Jews? Are they, you know, secularists? Are they following a Judaic religion in terms of the faith? Is it an ethnicity? It's been interestingly obfuscated, and it's still a landmine. And if you talk in a slightly sort of negative way against anything to do with the word Jew or the concept of the Jew, as a non-Jew, you're very likely to be pulled up for anti-Semitism or accused of racism. Some would say that it's quite a clever way of making sure that actually people don't say anything about it. But you're very brave in terms of trying to equate Judaism to the genocide. Now, that's not something which most people will do at all, because everybody, I mean, I've had guests on here, I've had rabbis from the Naturai Karta who'll assure me that the Judaism and the Torah and the Talmud have nothing to do with genocide. And then I've had, of course, reports talking about Amalek, talking about, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu talking about this, Gallant talking about it. What's the truth behind this? Is there really a genocidal tendency within some of these scriptures?
Okay, to start with, the genocidal tendency is a fact. It's not something that we question. It is the fact on the ground, and we see now how is it expanding to Iran. It was supposed to be a war of liberation of the Iranian people from their regime, and now it is actually a war against the Iranian people while accepting the regime. Okay, so the genocidal acts or enthusiasm, I would say, are facts on the ground. Now, let me tell you, there are some, or I would say one Jewish Orthodox segment called Satmar, and the Torah Jews and the Torah Karta are part of that segment.
Yes.
That is indeed against Zionism. We should be very clear about it. And they are inspired by their understanding of the Judaic religious code. All right? So, and I have nothing particularly bad to say about them in that regard. I actually, in my writing, always mentioned that there is a way to understand Judaism. Probably, I'm not part of their sect, not necessarily as ethical, but as a non-violent separatist perception. And they are a great example. Natura Carta, Torah Jews, Satmar. It's one sect. There are about 100,000 people out of 15 million Jews. And I can let you figure out what it means in terms of percentage. Now, on the other end, Israel is becoming more religious. And this is something that we have to understand. Zionism started as a secular movement. It actually aimed to amend the Jews, so to say. This is how they saw it themselves. The early Zionists, they identified some problems and they agreed with the anti-Semites, so to say, at the time, that there is a Jewish problem. The Jews are tended to associate themselves with elite, with money, power, and so on and so on. There was a very famous early Zionist called Baerbock, who said that every society is structured like a pyramid. We have many working class, less middle class, you know, academics, doctors, and very few bourgeoisies and capitalists. He said the Jewish society, Jewish diaspora society, is structured like upside down, and a pyramid, where you have at the bottom maybe one or two working class and a lot of capitalists and bourgeoisie at the top. The whole idea was to create a society that is proletarian, work-related, to make the Jews into farmers and factory workers and so on and so on. And this was the whole idea that kind of brought along the kibbutzim, I grew up part of my life in a kibbutz, you know, and I was very excited about the idea. And this is the philosophy that dominated Zionism until 48, and definitely was definitely officially defeated in 77 when the Likud party won the election, because the Likud party had a different vision. It had a vision of Jews being Jews rather than being people like all other people, like all other people. Okay?
Okay.
And that meant being proper capitalist society, money oriented. And in the 90s, I think 96 or 97, when Netanyahu was attempted the first time to become Israeli prime minister, and I think that he succeeded. I think it was 96 or 97, I don't remember exactly. He hired the services of Arthur Finkelstein in America, who was a prime election advisor. And Arthur Finkelstein told him that in order to help him being elected, he has to study what really drives the Jewish society metaphysically. And it was Arthur Finkelstein who found out in 96 or 97 that the vast majority of Jews actually identify as Jews rather than as Israelis.
Okay.
Okay?
Right.
And this made Netanyahu make a very clear decision that would move the Israeli society into strong political affiliation, spiritual affiliation with its Judaic segments. And the more Judaic the state became, the more violent it is, and the genocide in Gaza is an obvious example of that devastating shift. And I must tell you that obviously you can see I'm an old man, I'm 62, but when I watched videos or, you know, a live broadcast from Israel during this genocide, and I looked at the Israeli army and I looked at the fighting units, I could see that most of them, really most of them, it's shocking, were with skull caps, with a very clear a religious orthodox symbols, what they call the talits. It's something that they wear, you know, it's like the kind of strengthening coming out of the shirts. And yes, I can tell you that when I was a soldier, these people were not in the army. When I was a soldier, when my father was in the Air Force, the elite units were demographically dominated by kibbutznikim. Kibbutznikim is like the people who live in, young people who live in kibbutz,
sure,
were the product of labor Zionism, and they adhered to the thought of the Jews becoming something else. And that also meant being soldiers, and by the way, the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which is a humongous war crime, was committed by this secular labor Zionist Jews. It took me many years to understand that they didn't do it because they hate the Arabs.
Right.
They did it because they hated the diaspora Jews. Let me elaborate on
okay.
This. This is very interesting. This is fascinating. And this is the one thing that Ilan Pape wouldn't tell you.
Mm.
The 1948 Nakba happened 3 years after the liberation of Auschwitz.
I see.
Yeah. The Holocaust was perceived in young Israel or young Jewish state as a humiliating event in Jewish history.
Okay.
Here we are. We try to be different Jews. We try to be Hebrews. We don't want to be like the Polish Jews who go like lamb to the slaughter.
Right.
We are the young Jews and we fight from the hip. It's this rejection of the diaspora Jewish identity that brought the first phase of Israeli brutality. They were brutal because they didn't want to be Jews, diaspora Jews.
Okay.
And what is fascinating is that what we see in the Gaza genocide is the complete opposite. Is they are brutal because this is how they interpret the Jewish existence.
That's fascinating. I've never heard that strand, but that...
You will never, because you never heard it, because the whole task of the Jewish left and the Jewish intellectuals is to conceal the J element. This is why they always talk about Zionism. But I'll tell you something fascinating, and I'm sure that if you didn't hear it, if you didn't see it, you should see it. But a few days ago, Tucker Carlson had an interview with Avram Burg. Have you seen it?
No, I've not seen that.
Okay, it's a must watch. Not because I agree, but we know Tucker Carlson, and
of course,
and Avram Burg is a major Israeli intellect. For people who don't know him, he was the spokesman of the Knesset. He was the CEO of the Jewish Agency, which is the organization that taking care of all the Aliyah, the immigration to Israel. So he has a very strong Zionist background, and he's a very forceful dissident voice within Israel.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in the Wall interview, which was like 2 hours or something. And he was very critical. And by the way, his views are very similar to mine on many levels, on many issues. In the whole interview, he didn't mention the word Zionism once. For the Israelis, there is no such a thing as Zionism. I grew up in Israel. Zionism was something that belonged to my grandfather.
Wow.
He wanted to become a new one grandfather. My other grandfather was of a Palestinian, he was the Palestinian Jew, so he didn't right. he didn't care about all of that, you know.
Yeah.
My father's family were in Palestine.
They were Zionism. Ancestry Palestinians, yeah. Palestinians basically, ancestrally. Yeah.
Yeah. So. But one grandfather of mine was a proper Zionist, and he came to Palestine in 1936 with a dream of going through this transformation. When I was born in 63, you know, I looked at them as something, Zionism as something archaic, and most Israelis, if not all Israelis, look at Zionism as something archaic. When people talk to you about Zionism, it's because they're afraid to say, if they're leftists, it's because they're afraid to say the J word.
Right.
And if they are anti-Zionist Jews, it's because they want to divert the attention from the J word. And this is why I'm pretty repulsed by the entire discourse and don't want to be part of it anymore, you know, because we are really working hard on not addressing the real issues. And I wouldn't mind if this is the case, but we see genocide after genocide and after genocide, and now we are literally in a World War III that was triggered, without a doubt, by the Jewish state.
Well, I want to continue a little bit on this fascinating area that you've opened up. Jewish supremacy, is it being used by people like Finkelstein now as well, quite openly? He openly throws that word around. There are others who are talking about Jewish supremacy because Benjamin Netanyahu is talking in Jewish supremacist terms. Ben-Gavir is talking about it. Smotrich is talking about it. It's very hard to sort of deny that they feel that they have some kind of Pax Judaica, Jewish supremacy agenda. It's very hard to go against that. Others will argue. I'm sure there'll be lots of arguments against it. But what interests me is generally still now the conversation about Jewish supremacy is usually blotted out with this word Zionism. Say, why do you want to use the word Jewish supremacy when actually it's Zionism which is the problem? And we've been talking already in this program now about where this Jewish supremacy, Benjamin Netanyahu's type of supremacy, or his ilk's supremacy, where that's rooted, as you've talked about metaphysics and the religious element, can they actually use, say, the Talmud to justify their Jewish supremacy or their Israeli supremacy or their Pax Judaica? Is that because the rabbinical, I've heard rabbis also justifying it. So it must be somewhere in there. Am I wrong? Is it just fabricated by these guys and have they just invented it?
You're not wrong. Sorry that I'm interfering.
Please.
It's unpolite of me, but you know. Okay, so let me be clear, you know. Within the Judaic concept, the idea of chosenness could be interpreted as a duty, as a task, as a burden. And this is exactly when you had the rabbi from Sadman to Rekarta or whatever, this is most likely how they regard that issue of chosenness. Yeah?
Right.
We are chosen by God. By the way, I'm not saying that I accept it. I just present their position, you know?
Sure.
We are chosen by God to present an exemplary case of moral behavior and all this nonsense. This is their position. And I myself don't have an issue with this interpretation of chosenness. Mm. But when it comes to Jewish secularism, if you are secular, you're just born a Jew. You are a Jew because your mother is Jewish. What content are you going to fill this notion of chosenness with? So you may say, listen, I'm born a Jew and it means nothing to do. If you are a self-identifying Jew, very quickly, this chosenness is shifting into different type of supremacy. And this is something that we see. And it presents itself to the world as a sense of impunity. And this is exactly what we see when we look at Madoff or at Kushner or at Witkoff or at Dershowitz or at Epstein and also Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah.
There is another school of thought, and this is something to understand. Okay, so I presented to you the early Zionist school that had a wonderful dream to solve the Jewish problem, to make the Jews into people like all other people. And I would admit to you that I was myself very excited about it.
Right.
In fact, I left Israel because I realized that it's not working. But I believed in this idea in my early youth. Okay, so the Zionists start to make Aliyah, to introduce themselves to Palestine in the last few years of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Then we have first wave, second wave, third wave. And then in the 1930s, there is a rabbi who was the chief rabbi of Palestine at the time, called Rabbi Kook, K-O-O-K, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't adhere to the concept of Zionism. He didn't like the secularist movement, but he realized that there is a great opportunity here. And he started to develop a Jewish religious philosophy that evolved into the idea of Greater Israel and building a nation that is religiously oriented. And interestingly enough, Ben Gvir, Smotrich, the settler movements, all the radical, genocidal, brutal issues that we see now in the West Bank and before we saw in Gaza, are driven by his philosophy. So, in a way, Zionism, the way I see it, was a great moment of reflection in the Jewish world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was defeated by Judaism. Not the Judaism of Natura Carta and Satmer,
right,
but the Judaism of Rabbi Kook. Now, in Judaism, ethics is replaced by litigation. This is very, very important.
The law, yes.
The law. While ethics teaches you how to make moral judgment, yeah, and we can go to Immanuel Kant and to explain, for instance, what is the perception of, you know, you look into yourself and you come with a judgment that will be seen by others as a universal judgment. In Judaism, said, let's forget about all of that. Let's have law for everything. Don't sleep with your neighbor's wife. Don't kill them. Don't steal, all right?
Yeah.
And we have more and more and more laws, and the Talmud is this book of laws, for instance. In Judaism, the rabbi is the law. So when Satmar rabbi tell you, listen, this is our interpretation of Judaism, he's telling you the truth. This is their Judaism. But Rabbi Kook is also the law, and he's way more popular, and he's way more significant, because the genocide follows his interpretation of the Judaic code. Now, another very interesting aspect about it, Judaism is this body of law that is there to mimic the ethical act. Instead of behaving or thinking ethically, they mimic the act, the outcome, the output by building a very sophisticated legal system, a system that mimics human behavior is what we call nowadays AI. Oh. And what I'm telling you here is the Jews are doing AI for the last 3,000 years.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I'll have to get my head around that one. But yeah.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so they build a system that is mimicking, and I tell you something else. I was in 85 or 86, I was a student in Tel Aviv University, and I studied philosophy and math, and one day, they told me, listen, there is this school of cognitive science that we are starting, and we thought maybe you would like to attend this school. I was on my second or third year. I don't remember exactly. And it was fascinating because Noam Chomsky came to lecture to us, mm-hmm. and I already then realized that he is a big fake, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it was all about building language models and we studied linguistic, computer science, linguistic and computer science and philosophy. And I never understood what this school was all about. And I was more interested in military strategy. So when I had to do my extra points, you know, I went to study kind of in the departments that were closely related to the IDF, actually. But I always kind of asked myself, what was this school? What was it all about? And 20 years later, Israel became an empire in AI. All right? So they already in the 80s started to invest in this. They never told us. I never understood what it was all about. And I'm not even sure that Chomsky, who came to teach in this school, because we were kind of supposed to learn kind of linguistic models and to think how to create a language that, you know, that can talk to you the way AI is working now.
Yes.
You know, so it took me maybe, I say, 20 years, maybe another 40 years to understand what this was all about. But they are very sophisticated.
So it sounds to me like we're beginning to knit together this idea of a philosophical movement, a religious movement, combined with the politics of a greater Israel, and at the same time, technologically, you're saying that there was, of course, this conscious development of technology by a lot of the thinkers and the scholars and the people around the concept of Israel, which you have argued transformed from the 48 secular image that it had, yes, and it turned into this kind of theocratic, almost religious movement, which is now manifesting in essentially genocides. And I'm going to bring it to the contemporary period about what you think now, given that Israel has arrived where it's arrived. It's at the point where it's literally on the verge of causing a world war, potentially. Certainly a regional war has already kicked off.
Already.
Yeah, okay, that's your line. That's the suspicion many of us have. Yeah. But yeah. What is there any saving grace for Israel? What's the way out for them, intellectually, philosophically, or are they so gone now down this route of chosenness, this Pax Judaica, this Israeli imperialism, this forever wars and the domination of West Asia, that it's too late to salvage anything in terms of the existing Israel? And if that's the case, what's the alternative? What is the solution to this, to Israel as it is now?
You know, I'm a philosopher, and philosophers I mean, proper philosophers, and I'm a proper philosopher. Most philosophers, that's it, philosophy, and they don't ask themselves philosophical questions.
Right.
Philosophers refine questions. Activists produce answers. Okay. You ask me to be an activist, and I'm not willing to be.
Sure.
I don't like activists in general.
Okay.
But I like people who refine questions, because I believe that if you ever want to get at the position of answering a question, you must have a deep understanding of the fundamental question. This is what I learned from Heidegger. You know, he never answers. He always asks and asks and asks. If you want to talk about thinking, you have to ask yourself, what is thinking? But if you want to ask what is thinking, maybe first you should ask what is what, you know?
Well, they say 80% of an answer is in a good question. So if you question well...
Exactly. Now... It is quite pathetic because, I wouldn't like to see myself as a prophet, but everything that has happened now has been predicted by me in the most devastating terms, and I had demonstration against me for saying it. You know, I would come to a jazz gig in London in the Vortex, and there will be a bunch of Jewish Antifa, and said, he says that there will be a war in Iran, and here we are. I should put this segment that they always quote on my Facebook. It's a one-to-one. But I came to these answers because I asked the right questions. I said, this state doesn't call itself the Zionist state. It calls itself the Jewish state. It has Jewish symbols on its airplanes, on its bombs. So the first question that we have to ask, what the J word means, who are the Jews, what is Jewishness, what Judaism, how all these elements negotiate, you know, or deal with each other. And part of the things that we have to ask is, what is that thing the Jewish history can teach us? Devastatingly enough, nothing that we see now is new. Israel was born because Jews said, we were the tormented all our history, we suffer. And here you are. You come to a new region, and within 70 years or 100 years, you manage to make yourself hated by everyone around you.
They'll say that the Arabs attacked us. They'll say that the Arabs attacked us, and they attacked us because we're Jews, and because they hate us.
No, because my family lived in Palestine before Zionism, and Jews always lived in Palestine. Not big numbers. It was okay. You came to Palestine with an interesting idea. I'm saying Zionism is an interesting idea. And you very quickly started to celebrate your symptoms on the expense of the others, which is exactly what you did in Europe. Now, there is a book that I wrote and I never published. But the motto of this book is quite simple. I look at Zionism as a very healthy moment of self-awareness. And let's forget about the Nakba for a second, about the 48th ethnic cleansing. They come to Palestine with a dream to go through a metamorphosis. that will make them into, and this is Herzl, people like all other people. And as I said, the Nakba is not because they hated the Arabs. They didn't want to be like the European Jews who go like lamb to the slaughter. So they had a tantrum on the Arabs, and they kicked 70% of them out, which is, of course, this is Israel's original sin. And the country evolves politically, and the kibbutz, you know, you seem to me like more or less my age, maybe a bit younger.
Yes, we're about the same.
We're about the same.
About a year out, yeah.
You probably came across a lot of European, slightly older than us, that went to Israel and worked in the kibbutzim. Have you ever come across this?
Yes,
this
yes.
Generation?
Yes, I have.
You know, many Germans, they went and said, wow, I remember, because I grew up partially in the kibbutz. You know, we have the volunteers. Yeah, the volunteers were European from Sweden, from Germany, from England, from the United States. They came to work. We used to call them the slaves, Avadim, you know, because they used to go to work. They were not part of the community, you know. And it was looked by Westerners as a miracle. Israel was looked at by others, by European, by Western countries, as a miracle. As the Jews managed to reform themselves, they became something else, and they are fighters, and they are so on and so on and so on. And then we have the 1967 war that, in the Israeli eyes, and for a reason, it is regarded as a magnificent, unrealistic victory, in which the country managed to win a substantial military victory over five Arab states to destroy their air force in 4 hours. They said, they call it the six days war, because it was very short. It was basically a blitzkrieg, which is they adopted the German tactic, starting with the Israeli Luftwaffe, with the Israeli Air Force, destroying Arab air forces, and then following by quick tanks maneuver. And what happened in Israel at that moment in 67 is part of the Israelis see it as a miracle, as a divine intervention.
Mm.
And many, many diaspora Jews look at it the same. It suddenly, Israel becomes an option, something that the Jews around the world can identify with. But for the Zionist, so-called Israelis, who were in this kind of maneuver of shifting from being diaspora Jews into a new Hebrew people, this means that the revolution has been accomplished.
Right.
This is the moment that Israel stops being a revolutionary society. We are in 67. It's a landmark in Israeli history, and now we look at the 10 years that happened between 67 to 77. 77 is when the Likud is taking over. And pretty much since then, the Likud is
so
dominating. They were small.
As a conclusion to this historical and, you know, philosophical kind of overview given us of this transformation, do you think now that it is, in your estimation, basically a theocratic, Judaic project or society, do you think it can? There's a solution. Can it live side by side with the Arabs? Can it make peace in its region? Or what's the end game? Do you see, Gilad?
You asked me again to be an activist, but it's very clear.
Yeah.
But it's very clear that it's it's going nowhere. It's going nowhere. What is amazing to watch is the resilience. They are living in an unbearable situation now. By the way, maybe you don't like what I'm saying now, but
no.
I see on Facebook and on Twitter and social media say, oh, the Iranian destroying Israel. They destroyed Haifa refineries, and they destroyed Ashdod port and Elat port. And Tel Aviv is like Gaza. Sorry, it's nonsense. I follow it closely.
Right.
And I think that the Iranian can do it, but the damage to Israel so far is cosmetic. It's cosmetic. Okay? This cluster missiles are pushing them into their shelters. But it's not that they go out of the shelters and they say, oh, where is our city? Okay? We are not there. We may get there. The Iranians are not doing it for many reasons. Partially because they are dealing with a genocidal, suicidal entity with 400 or 300. I don't know exactly. They didn't tell me. They didn't send me the right last report. nuclear bombs. Okay, these people just committed a genocide in Gaza. They won't be. They won't refrain from doing the same in Iran. You ask yourself, why do they? Why do they need 300 or 400 nuclears, you know, nukes, because they are genocidal, okay? And they're also suicidal. And why I'm saying they're suicidal? Because the Samson narrative and the Masada narrative are prime narrative in the Israeli, in the new Hebraic culture. When you are in the tank battalion, you swear to the army in Masada. Masada is a suicidal event. I mean, for people who don't know, Masada, it's kind of an historical event where kind of a zealot Jews kind of fought to the end, the Romans, yeah?
Okay, right.
There are Israeli IDF units called after Samson, yeah? You know? So these are prime narrative, and these are suicidal narrative. Now, there is another thing that I thought about in the last few days. I'm sorry that you asked me a question instead of like telling you like an activist, oh, Israel will be gone, you know. I have to elaborate on the fundamentals that shape the understanding of such a question.
I appreciate that.
Okay, so I apologize for doing it, but it, for me it's necessary. No.
We need a deeper. I'm really trying to get a deeper understanding of what makes these
exactly.
Israelis
so,
tick. Yes.
So fundamentally, genocidal as well as suicidal. This is very important to understand. Now, we look at the Jewish ghetto, European Jewish ghetto. Was it something that the European imposed on them? This is a big historical question. Many people will tell you, many scholars, I mean, that it's actually something that the Jews preferred to be in. Even Nordau, who was one of the first Zionists, you know, in his speech on the first Zionist Congress, he spoke about the ghetto being a very safe environment for the Jews, where they could celebrate the symptoms without being intimidated by the going by the. And here we are. We have a Zionist state where Jews supposed to become people like all other people. It becomes Israel, the Jewish state. And within 20, 30 years, they start to build bigger and bigger walls around it. and they become a ghetto.
Right.
They become a ghetto in the Middle East, the biggest ghetto ever. And they manifesting exactly the symptom that they were supposed to eradicate, which is amazing. And then we look at Anne Frank. Anne Frank is a story of a girl that is kind of locked in an attic and she is hiding from the Nazis and blah, 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 blah. And I kind of came across it as a young Israeli. And I never kind of knew what to think about it. But it was supposed to be kind of a tormenting event in our past.
Yes.
And you look at them now, and it's a nation of Anne Frank. They are all the time hiding with the family, blah, 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 blah. And then they don't protest against it. They like it like that. They don't protest. I don't see the... Of course, I can see some Israeli dissenters. But the other day, 3 or 4 days ago, there was a demonstration against the war. And there were 300 people. Yeah. Okay, in a nation of 10 million people. So in America, there were 9 million people in the streets for no kings. If this would be kind of proportionally, you would expect 300,000 people in Israel.
Sure.
The 300, it's one promile. It's 1,000th of what the American brought to the street.
Right.
So the meaning is, and I didn't need even all this introduction, that they are sustained by negation. The negation unites them. And one of the most devastating things that I understood about the Jewish world and the Jewish universe, the Jewish metaphysics, the Jewish being in the world, is that they are designed culturally to bring disasters on themselves. So it's not a coincidence that they were expelled from 100 or 107, and people argue what is the number, but you know, we look in the recent history and we see that they are getting into a lot of trouble, you know, in Europe, in Eastern Europe, you know, the pogroms, and now in America.
But they explained that as being anti-Semitic, that was European anti-Semitism, persecution of Jews.
Yeah, but, you know, of course, but I... And this got me into a lot of trouble. I don't believe that people hate other people for what they are, but for what they do.
Okay.
Yeah. Nobody. I believe nobody. I'm serious about it. Including Hitler, hates Jews for being Jews.
Mm.
He, that, you know, I read Hitler among one of my crimes. I read, you know, how can you understand the...
Well, the early Zionist history. Movement, the early Zionist movement is said to have worked with Hitler. He agreed that Jews needed a separate place, and ideally he wanted to get rid of them from Germany. So the Zionists would have been quite happy to work with him to say, let's shift German Jews to a new place, i.e. Palestine, perhaps.
Of course, there were... There were definitely segments within the Zionist movement that were happy to work with Hitler. We also know about the Avara agreement.
Balfour, it's said that Balfour went for this option as well because he also wanted to get rid of Jews. So there was this kind of European colonialist thing of like, let's get rid of the Jews somewhere else, get rid of the problem.
and Churchill as well. So, so there is a kind of a, so anti-Semitism should be, I believe, looked upon as a symbiotic event. Is something that also serve the Jews and unite them and sustain their cultural cohesiveness.
Yeah. But now, I want to talk about a little bit about Purim, because it's a story of Esther, and you'll probably give me more details on it. But the attack on Iran this time, this round, began symbolically around Purim, and of course. The Iranians.
I don't think that it was symbolically. I think that America, being the foolish place it is, was pulled into carrying this criminal war in this date that was supposed to be a cathartic Jewish moment. Now, I was somewhere in Europe, and I think that I got the first beeper. You know, I didn't sleep since then, and kind of reporting all the time about what is happening.
Sure.
Maybe 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. It was in the morning, the first attack. And within 15 minutes, I went to have coffee somewhere, and I wrote my piece about Purim. And they did it 2 days before Purim. And I thought, wow, this is very courageous of me to write this thing. And then 2 hours later, I see in the Jewish press and in the Jewish writer in the New York Times, this is Purim. We made it for Purim. Now, what is Purim? Purim is the most joyous Jewish holiday, and is, by the way, a holiday that is celebrated by all Jews, pretty much, not just the religious. Yeah, definitely a big celebration in Israel, but it's a story of so-called a guy, an anti-Semitic guy called Aman, who didn't like the Jews, and he was an advisor to the Persian king. In the Book of Esther, it is called Ahasuerus, Ezerus, basically. And the Jews are very worried about it. And they manage to get Queen Esther, who is a Jewish young woman, to become Ahasuerus, the king's new wife. And she persuades him, it's basically an Epstein story, she persuades him to go against Aman, and eventually Aman and I think 70,000 of his tribe are being massacred. It's basically a genocide. Mm. And this is the most joyous festival. The war against Iran started 1.5 days ahead of that event. And it's a war against Persia. It's old Persia in Purim, modern Persia, Iran. And this is why it was so important to target the supreme leader, who is a top Shia identity. It's like killing the Pope. So this was there to locate this war in the context of a religious war and to have the Jews winning the way ahead of Purim, you know? So Purim become... Okay, so this is where we are.
So given that they actually believe in this kind of messianic reality of the temple, and of course, on the other side, the Iranians are also part of have a Masonic philosophy around the Mahdi, and of course, both are going for this war, which is for them existential. It's not existential for the Americans. But the Iranians don't necessarily want to stop this war because they're saying we want a final end to this kind of attack on us by the Israelis and the Americans. And the Israelis are saying we need to get rid of Iran because without doing that, we can't be safe and we can't also essentially dominate the Zionist Arab dictatorships, which I think that they are very connected to Zionism. People like Salman, bin Salman and all these guys. So we've got two forces which aren't going to back off, which have religious and spiritual messianic ideologies, which regard it inevitable that there's going to be a collision. And of course, there's narratives of oppression on both sides. These Israelis will have convinced themselves that they are the oppressed. They are under attack. They're under threat constantly. And they have to do this in order to survive. The Iranians, similarly, are saying, basically, we're being attacked for our vilayat-e faqih in our system of governance, our independence, our sovereignty. And we need to take this all the way. Are we heading to Armageddon?
Again, you repeat doing this, you know. You ask me to be a prophet.
I keep asking you to bring the crystal ball out.
My answer is we are dealing with a genocidal, suicidal entity, and if this is not enough, this society or this collective as a very solid notion of a Gog Umagog war. Have you heard this notion?
Yes, I have. It's called Yajuj Majuj in the Islamic tradition, but Gog Magog, of course, we're familiar.
Yeah. So the Gog Umagog is a final disastrous colossal destruction of the world in which the Jews, it's a biblical narrative, the Jews prevail over what is left of the universe.
Okay. So they'd be quite happy with a nuclear fallout, and that mean that basically everything gets contaminated in West Asia, perhaps even Israel itself. Do you think they've got no concern about a potential nuclear attack on Iran?
I'm concerned. I tell you the truth. I'm concerned because I can see that a total destruction of everything around them, and by the way, maybe some European states like Spain or Ireland, the anti-Semites, they see them, is well within their sickening worldview.
Right.
Okay, so there is nothing really hidden, you know. I'm quoting myself now, but I always tell people there are no Jewish conspiracies. They do everything in the open.
Right.
They just don't allow you to talk about it. And I'm talking about it.
Well, Gilad, you've given us a fantastic journey through this very, very difficult topic. But I can't really pick up on a lot of the things that I would disagree with you on. It's very hard to, you know, look at crystal balls, and I'm sorry I had to try and get you to pin down on that. But at the end of the day, it does seem as though Donald Trump has achieved actually the opposite of everything that he wanted. Iran will continue to have nuclear capacity. It will not give up its ballistic missiles. It now is selling oil, which it couldn't. It was before, of course, sanctioned. The Americans have now said Iranian oil can be sold through the Hormuz. the Russians are able to sell oil. Of course, we've got a far more galvanized Iran as a result of all this. The Iranian people, if they had any differences, are all together as well. And we've seen a public relations disaster in terms of Israel and America across the world. Everybody now kind of sees them as the evil empire in a way. So they've scored a lot of goals. I completely agree with you. Where it all heads, if it goes to nuclear Armageddon, of course, that's something that's going to knock all of us. But what's for sure is that economic Armageddon is on the way. If that Hormuz stays shut and the Bab al-Mandeb also gets closed down, then we've got a real economic disaster, which we're all going to feel the impact of. We're going to love to have you back again to go at these topics once again. Thank you so much for giving us your time. And, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, and there's a lot of issues that we probably left a little bit loose, which we'll revisit. But thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. And to the audience, I'd say...
Sorry. It was amazing for me to talk because I really didn't do it for since COVID. I kind of retired from any public, I don't know, so there was something about, I saw some of your posts on Facebook and thought this guy can think, because I'm not interested, because everywhere you go now, we are living in society kind of.
Yes, yes, it's all fast food and fast information, yes. Fake news. And,
yeah, but everybody says the same thing, and my understanding of everything is slightly different. I don't say deeper.
No, I think that's exactly what Deep Dive wants, and I think that we've had two very distinct kind of analyses, which both of them have triggered a lot of, I think, knowledge for people who really want to know the truth. And I think, of course, we all pray that war ends. We pray that there's solutions in the world. Absolutely. We pray that there's peace, and we pray that everybody can live in a coexistent way. But it does seem as though there are these forces that seem to have taken hold of very, very large institutions, powerful institutions, which are hell-bent on destroying our world as we know it. Now, I would say again to our audience, thank you for watching. Do like, share, subscribe. Follow Gilad on Facebook. I follow him regularly, and he's always putting some fascinating thoughts and ideas together, and you'll learn a lot, I think. It's also a fascinating question for people to look at. Identity, you know, the identitarian politics, which has penetrated the world's mindset through a deliberate set of neoliberal agendas, which divide men from women, divide ethnicity from ethnicity, nationality against nationality, you know, that try to create tensions.
By the way, the first person to write a critical book of identitarian politics and the first person who analyzed it was actually me.
Oh, wow. Well, that's enough. Let's schedule that as another discussion, and we're going to have to go for that. But thank you all for watching this this particular edition. Like, share, subscribe to the channel. We need your support. Without that, we can't continue what we're doing and bringing on these fascinating, you know, countercultural voices, which are often suppressed by mainstream with one sort of cancelling culture or another. Gilad, thank you for joining us again, sir. And we look forward to re-inviting you in the future. And we look forward to you watching us on the next edition of the Deep Dive Perspective.